Great to have with me Mark Rubenstein for another conversation about his newsletter, Net Interest. And Mark, last week you addressed a very timely topic. I think many of us hadn't even heard of DTCC until the GameStop saga. So, and many probably still don't know what it stands for. But you go into some history and provide a really great overview of what those kinds of organizations do and the role they serve in the market. So why don't we just get right into it? Tell us about you know, the history and how we should think about these entities.
Well, one of the things I'm fascinated with, John, is market structure. We've spoke a few weeks ago about benchmarking, about indices. A lot of the workflows in markets currently revolve around stock indices, and the companies that manufacture those stock indices are very interesting. They tend towards a monopoly, and increasingly they are owned by exchange groups, companies like London Stock Exchange, which owns the Russell Indices, CME, which has got a stake in S&P and their indices, and so on. There is, and that's a huge source of power for those exchange groups. A few months ago, I wrote a piece called The New Power Brokers, which argued that the investment banks that used to wield the most power in markets no longer do, and that mantle has now been passed to exchange groups, and they derive their power from two sources. One is their control of indices. So clearly there's a lot of focus on the big passive asset managers like BlackRock and Vanguard, but they are reliant on the intellectual property around those stock indices, which is owned by exchange groups. That's one source of power. The second source of power, and that's the topic of last week's piece, is clearing and settlement, which is hugely important. It goes on underneath the floorboards. People, I don't think, who buy and sell, and I'll be honest, John, as a professional investor, I was rarely aware of what happened once I gave the nod to the trader to buy or sell some stock. I suspect I'm not unusual. A lot of investors don't necessarily know what goes on beneath the floorboards at the beating heart of the market once they have pushed the button on a trade. And occasionally, and most of the time that's fine. Occasionally, just like the analogy here is plumbing. The analogy here is household plumbing. When it works well, that's great. It's not noticeable. When it goes wrong, it becomes noticeable, and then it becomes a real problem. And the plumbing about 2 weeks ago became, I wouldn't say a problem, but it certainly made the front pages to a degree that's not normally the case around the GameStop Robin Hood saga. And what happened was Robin Hood was told, and its chief executive and founder went on Clubhouse a week or so ago. He was interviewed by Elon Musk, and he explained that what happened was in the middle of the night. It was Thursday night. Middle of the night, it was 3:30 a.m. Pacific time. His people got a call from the biggest clearinghouse involved in cash equities markets and made a demand for a $3 billion additional deposit with them. What's all that about? And that's what I delved into this week. So what I've delved into this week is clearing, its history, and specifically that clearing entity that made that call to Vlad Tenev, who's the chief executive and founder of Robinhood, asking for the $3 billion.
Fascinating. And as I understand it, the U.S. entity is a little bit of an anachronistic type of organization as compared to some of the others around the world. But why don't we just start with a little bit of history? And I think it illustrates why this is a very important part of the market structure. And I guess you have a personal connection to some of that history, given that some of it took place in your hometown.
Exactly. So listeners may or may not pick up on my accent. I'm from Liverpool, which is a town in the city in the northwest of England. I grew up on the same street that John Lennon did and spent obviously my formative years there. Liverpool in the 19th century was one of the most significant ports in the world. It was a key port, obviously within England, but by extension in the British Empire. And given its location on the west coast of the United Kingdom, was the premier port at that time for traffic across the Atlantic to and from the United States. And it became, as a result, a major port in the 19th century for the import of cotton, which would come in from the United States. It would then be bought by spinners in Lancashire, which was in England a hive of the fabric industry, big consumers of cotton. Before the American Civil War, the market worked on a cash basis. Importers, merchants would import the cotton. Once it reached dock, then they would sell it to the brokers, through the brokers, to the weavers and the spinners in Lancashire, cash market. When the American Civil War struck, the volatility in the cotton price increased significantly. And as a result of that, a future market. Initially, it was a forward market, and then that evolved into a futures market developed in Liverpool around cotton, whereby merchants would be able to sell forward the cotton they were importing from the US in order to protect their position. What that meant is speculators were then able to participate. They could take a view on the future price of cotton without having to take delivery, because they could trade on the contract before they needed to take delivery. Classic evolution of a futures of a derivatives market of the type that we've seen in Chicago around grain, and actually in Japan as well in the 18th century around rice. But here it was developing around the cotton market in Liverpool in the second half of the 19th century. And then an innovation happened. There was a specific cotton broker in Liverpool. His name is Joseph Morgan. And the problem emerged that because the cotton was bought and sold so many times before the delivery actually took place, there was a long, long chain of commitments that took a while to untangle once the contract expired. And what he did was he established a clearing house, which would untangle all of those commitments along the chain. And it was a much, much more efficient process. There was a bit of opposition at the time. People thought, well, it makes it easier for speculators, all through the history of financial markets. And we're seeing it again right now with Robin Hood. There is suspicion that the easier it is to trade, the more gambling-like it becomes. And that fear, certainly it's around today, and it was around then as well. And the clearinghouse was seen as a mechanism through which trading could become easier, and people opposed it on that basis. But it took off, and then over the 1870s and over the 1880s, Joseph Morgan, he tweaked the model. He introduced a process of weekly settlement dates so that the chain could be cleaned up, if you like, and cash could be reallocated from those on one side of the trade to those on the other side of the trade on a weekly basis, rather than waiting until the contract completely matured, when some investors, some speculators may have found they got themselves too overexposed. So he introduced some innovations. He introduced credit as well. A number of innovations, and the clearinghouse was basically born. in Liverpool in 1870s and 1880s. As I say, there's a caveat here. It did exist in Japan, in Osaka, around the rice market. But in the Western world, it really emerged in Liverpool in that time period. And then it took off. Various other commercial trading centers, both in Europe and the United States, adopted the model. It was adopted in Le Havre on the coast of France, around the coffee market. It was adopted in Minneapolis, around the grain market. And today, clearinghouses are now the cornerstone for the trading of derivatives, certainly, but also for cash securities. And they offer two benefits, some of which we've seen in our analysis of Joseph Morgan's Liverpool Cotton Clearinghouse. One benefit is that they net off positions among counterparties. And the second is that, and this was really the innovation of Minneapolis, where they said, we will insert ourselves directly in the trade and become the buyer to every seller and the seller to every buyer. And what that did is it eliminates any kind of credit risk, any kind of counterparty risk, any kind of settlement risk, and also increased anonymity in the markets. So the buyer did not have to know the seller and was guaranteed that the seller would commit to settling the contract, to delivering either the cash or the physical in the case of a derivative, and vice versa, vis-a-vis the buyer. So these are the two benefits that clearinghouses bring to the efficiency, the efficient running of capital markets. And that's still very much the case today.
As you describe that, you know, I'm conjuring up the image I have of an exchange. And obviously today, except for the DTCC, which is an industry consortium, some clearing houses are owned by exchanges, but can you just clarify a little bit the separate, what functions are separate in a way between the exchange function and the clearing function?
So typically, when we think about market structure, we think about trading execution, which is the process of price discovery. We then think about clearing, which is the process through which the underlying, whether it's stock or whether it's the derivative, is transferred one way, and in the opposite direction, the cash is transferred. And relating to that, in order to ease that process, a lot of the clearing companies today, they actually retain the ownership of underlying stock. So the company we're going to go on and talk about in a little bit more detail is DTCC, which is the American clearinghouse for not only for stock, but also for mortgage-backed securities and other asset classes as well. DTCC stands for the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation. And what they do is they actually retain title for all of the stocks in the US. So the DTC, which is a subsidiary of the DTCC, all of the stocks basically reside with it. So if you're selling me some stock, you know, clearly in the old days, look, John, when I started in this business, I'm not quite that old. When I first started investing or trading as a teenager, we had 14-day in the UK, 14-day settlement periods. So once every 2 weeks, roughly twice a month, there'd be a settlement period. And it was required to be that long because I had to post my physical certificate to a broker, who would then ultimately get it to the buyer if I was selling and vice versa if I was buying. In order to collapse that process and make it a lot more efficient, the DTC, which is a subsidiary of the DTCC, retains title for all of the stocks in the US. So basically, the transfer can occur very, very quickly because all the certificates are housed in one roof. There's actually an interesting story where when physical certificates were, and still are in the cases of some asset classes, prevalent, I can't remember which hurricane it was. Might have been there was a specific weather event in New York which led to flooding in downtown New York, and the vaults of the DTCC in New York flooded, damaging lots of the stock certificates that they were holding on behalf of legal owners. So that's kind of the way it works. And then the final element of the chain is the settlement when it's all done. So there's all of these elements. Now, you raise an interesting question around the structure of trading and clearing and settlement. And historically, in the derivatives markets, so actually Minneapolis was interesting. I use that as a historical stepping stone to where we are today. The Minneapolis Clearinghouse was set up separately from the exchange, which existed in Minneapolis. Eventually, certainly in the derivatives markets, most clearinghouses merged into the exchanges. And in derivatives, that's kind of quite easy. There's a lot of value on the clearing side, and the exchange can actually, by controlling that whole value chain, can almost give away execution, can do execution very, very cheaply, in some cases below cost, and make up for it on the custody side. And for all of these elements, certainly it's true in trading, it's also true for clearing, there's a kind of network effect where the bigger you are, this is kind of a well-known phenomenon in trading, the bigger you are, the more likely you are to exhibit liquidity, and therefore the more attractive you become, and therefore the bigger you become. And it's the same on the clearing side as well. With derivatives, the intellectual property of the derivative contract is owned by the exchange, which manufactures that contract. And therefore, it was easy for them to incorporate the clearing components of that process. For stocks, for cash, equities, it's slightly different because the intellectual property is with the issuer, with Apple, with IBM, with Bank of America, and not with the exchange. And so historically, clearing in cash equities was run by independent organizations outside of the exchanges. Now, interestingly, in Europe, we've seen a divergence of strategy versus the US. In Europe, we've seen the exchanges take control of the clearinghouses. So in European cash equities today, two clearinghouses control 80% of the market. One of them is based in the Netherlands, one of them is based in London, actually with an operation in Paris as well. That one's owned by the London Stock Exchange. The other one's owned by CBOT, the American exchange company. In the US, it evolved very, very differently. In the US, we have a mutual organization, which is the DTCC, which is owned by its members, by its users, which are typically the big Wall Street houses. So Goldman Sachs is an owner and a user. Morgan Stanley is an owner and a user. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, is an owner and a user, and so on. It's actually quite interesting, and maybe listeners have the answer to this. I couldn't get to the bottom when I did my research on why there's been that divergence of strategy, in particular because one might think that Europe would be the traditional home of a more mutual, at-cost, not-for-profit type of structure rather than the US. But actually, we've got the mutual structure in stock clearing in the US, and not in Europe.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, another area where that seems to be the case or has been is in the banking side, where you have a lot of, a lot more smaller banks that are organized, I believe, in a mutual way in the US than in Europe. But on the clearing side itself, you know, one of the issues that was raised as part of this saga we just lived through has been that T+3 settlement and why we don't have real-time settlement yet. Do you have a view on what it would take to get to real-time settlement?
Well, it's an interesting question, and Robinhood have argued that the solution to the problems that they were confronted with a couple of weeks ago would have been real-time settlement. And the reason why they propose real-time settlement as a solution is because T+2 introduces some credit risk into the process, and the clearinghouse assumes all of that credit risk, hence the requirement for Robinhood to post additional margin in order to protect the clearinghouse from the risk that Robinhood was injecting into it, given what their customers were doing and the concentration around one or two specific stocks and the volatility of those two specific stocks. Don't need to go into the mechanics of that, but that's been their response. And there's been a big public debate as a result of that. So Sheila Bair, who a policymaker in the United States, has come out in favor, as of various others. The problem with the benefit, and clearly there are technology solutions that are available today that weren't around in the 1870s and the 1880s in the city of Liverpool, nor subsequently in the city of Minneapolis. However, I'd make a number of points. Firstly, the DTCC, which we've spoken about, it's a staggering number. And this was in 2019. So I don't have the 2020 data yet, but in 2019, they processed 2.15 quadrillion. You don't read much about quadrillions worth of securities, over 2 quadrillion worth of securities. And they were able to collapse that down because of the netting into a much more manageable 120 trillion. Big number, but not quite as big. So they were able to absorb 94% of the money flows in order to collapse that down. There are some benefits to centralization. So there's a lot of discussion right now about blockchain and about decentralization, but it's not clear that technology is yet able to process that volume that efficiently or that quickly that the DTCC is able to do it. So that's one point. Second point is that if we're going to get a real time, we need to pre-fund. And that's fine for cash accounts, and it might be fine for kind of domestic trading. But when it comes to institutional trading, where there's some foreign exchange involved, having to do that foreign exchange in advance of executing the underlying stock trade, having to do the sell in advance of the buy if it's a reallocation. So the sell is real time, so we're not waiting for clearing, but the money has to be there from the sell before the buy is executed. So there are various drawbacks from real time. Interestingly, it was tried in Russia. Russia went real time, and maybe, and clearly it's a kind of peripheral market in the context of global equity markets. But they backpedaled and went back to T+2 because of the problems of attracting foreign capital through the FX issue and this process, this difficulty of having to align buys and sells. So it could be the market's not quite ready for real time yet. Although we may go down to T+1, T+1.5, regardless, any kind of T+ is to the benefit of the clearing houses, which sit at the heart of that process. Don't make that much money on the cash side, but the DTCC income statement I looked at in the context of this, they actually make 1.9 billion of revenues every year, but there's 1.5 billion of operating costs in there. And because it's a mutual, of the 400 million balance, about half goes back to its users and the other half goes in tax. But they, so it's not that profitable in cash, but in derivatives, it can be very, very profitable. And actually, if we look at London Stock Exchange and look at some of the exchanges, they derive quite considerable earnings and value more broadly through the kind of cross-selling and the fact that they're able to benefit from economies of scale, value more broadly from the clearing mechanism.
So it's interesting that, you know, DTCC is basically a not-for-profit, or more accurately, that the profit goes back to the to the owners or the users of it. I'm wondering whether it could move to more of a public type of company down the road, similar to what happened with Visa, and whether that would change the business in any way.
It's interesting. So when I looked at the new power brokers, which was a piece I did a few months ago, I mentioned it earlier, which charted this shift in power post global financial crisis from the broker dealers to the exchanges. We've seen, actually, the story goes, it's a longer story than just post global financial crisis. There's been this tension between broker dealers and exchanges for as long as technology has enabled alternative venues to develop over which to do trading. So if we go back even to the early 2000s, a lot of the broker dealers tried to compete with exchanges by setting up their own dark pools and by setting up their own ECNs. And there's this kind of flow. And don't forget, the New York Stock Exchange itself used to be owned by the broker dealers. They then, so you use the example of Visa, the New York Stock Exchange itself is a very good example. It was demutualized. And there's this been this power play, this kind of flow of power between the broker dealers and the exchanges for a long, long time. And as I say, listeners who want to understand that a bit more, the new power brokers was the piece that I published on September the 4th of last year about that. But to your point, right now, it kind of feels that the power, with the power ebb the way it is, the users are unlikely to want to give up control over that clearing asset. And therefore, right now, it doesn't feel, I guess what I'm saying is I'd frame this more broadly in terms of the overall politics of exchanges, broker dealers, and the whole kind of ecosystem. And it doesn't feel likely right now, given that they've already given up post-financial crisis, they gave up OTC. So post-financial crisis, actually, this is an important point we didn't mention. Post-financial crisis, they gave up the broker dealers over-the-counter derivatives. They gave that up to clearinghouses as a requirement of regulations that came in post-financial crisis, and that was the benefit of the clearinghouses and the detriment of broker-dealers. So given where we are, it feels unlikely that the broker-dealers will want to give up access to that asset, but clearly it remains to be seen.
Well, certainly interesting. I doubt that the banks that own DTCC get much credit for that ownership in their valuations. When you look at banks, they're valued perhaps on a multiple of book value, and yet I would imagine DTCC would be valued more like an exchange at a much higher multiple. But it's an interesting question whether it would be good for the system to have a entity that's operating like a public company, where perhaps then the incentive is to get even more trading going, to get even more sort of the gambling in the market that's already at quite a high level, it seems.
Yeah, it's a trade-off, isn't it, between these businesses that tend towards monopoly, that have network effects such that the bigger they get, the bigger they get. There's a trade-off between, and clearly it's a big topic of discussion in technology broadly, but there's a trade-off between allowing them the monopoly and then heavily regulating them, or allowing and heavily regulating them away from exploiting that monopoly through higher pricing, or allowing some competition, which therefore isn't as competitive, but because of the competition, that benefit isn't necessarily, that the detriment of that isn't necessarily absorbed by the end user, because competition kind of offsets that. So classic trade-off. In Europe, we have a bit more competition. In Europe, we have a bit more competition. In the US, it's heavily regulated. So the monopoly is allowed. It's permissible, but it's very heavily regulated. In fact, the DTCC is regarded as, by Washington, as, so we all know what a systemically important financial institution is. It's too big to fail bank. But there are also a small group of companies that are classified as systemically important market utilities, and DTCC is one of them.
I guess the way that structure works in the US right now opens it up to those conspiracy theories that resurface whenever there is a situation like GameStop, or I remember back in the day when Overstock.com was a heavily shorted stock, their CEO was making some charges that the DTCC was allowing a lot of failures to deliver, to accumulate, essentially helping the shorts. So I'm wondering whether some kind of evolution in that structure would help to do away with those kinds of theories getting credence.
It's a good point. I mean, to be fair to them, their disclosure is very good. They file financial reports. They've got a website. I was shown one podcast that the chief executive officer of DTCC did. So, but certainly, and again, this is a key distinction between Europe and the US. I think in the US, public companies tend to have a presence in the market, which non-listed companies don't. Actually, that's something that a lot of companies exploit. They often in their listing materials, in their S1s, they say one of the reasons why we're going public is to increase our market presence, there's a marketing component to that. So it's a difference between Europe and the US. I can see that. And certainly maybe you're right. These conspiracy theories emerge because it's a less well-known company. But it's a very big company.
And just lastly, this point that, when they called up Vlad Tenev at 3 a.m. in the morning and they gave that 3 billion number, which was an order of magnitude greater than what they normally get, Vlad says that basically the calculation, there's a big discretionary component, and they were able to get that down quite a bit after going back and forth. What would have happened, and presumably this number that's required is to protect the DTCC from that volatility. What would happen in your mind if there was an issue on the DTCC side? Would the taxpayer be ultimately on the hook?
Yeah, it's a big issue. It's a really important issue. So the clearinghouses globally. So the track record, one of the reasons, so I mentioned in passing earlier that OTC, over-the-counter derivatives, went to clearinghouses following the global financial crisis at the request of regulators. One of the reasons why regulators were so keen to do that is they saw clearinghouses as a solution to the problems that emerged in the global financial crisis. Because they fulfilled their duties remarkably well, actually. So Lehman in London, so Lehman was sitting on an interest rate portfolio of $9 trillion on September 2008 when it went bankrupt. The London-based clearinghouse, which today is owned by the London Stock Exchange, had the unenviable task of sorting out that mess, and they did it with aplomb. They did it well with no losses. And the regulators noticed, hence the change in law, which is captured in the US anyway, in Dodd-Frank. But it's a big issue. And there's a paradox almost. The paradox is these clearinghouses tend to monopoly and they get bigger. And then they have regulatory sanction as well. Regulators like them as well. And so more and more. So, and the paradox is by reducing risk around the counterparties in the market, they're internalizing that risk in on themselves. So we have these nodes in the financial system currently, which is why, to be fair, the financial regulators in Washington deem the DTCC a systemically important market utility. But the risk now embedded within them, whether it's DTCC, whether it's LCH ClearNet in London, whatever it is very, very high, very high. Now, the history of clearing has been quite successful. There have been three, and I look at this in, there's a PhD thesis, which I cite at the end of my piece. It's, and he looks at this. He basically, Lorenzo Ganito is his name, and he writes What Markets Fear, a PhD thesis, and he looks at, there have been three clearinghouse failures in history, and he looks at the circumstances surrounding them. But it's certainly, absolutely, 100% something that I think regulators probably lose sleep over at night, and it is a big risk, such that if the fall guy is Robinhood and Robinhood's investors, Silicon Valley venture capital based investors, have to come up with $3.4 billion in order to protect Robinhood, which in turn is to protect the DTCC, then the system's kind of working. And there's a number of, so the deposit they put in or the margin they put down, they have to know, you know, not anyone can have a position with a clearinghouse. They have to be known to the clearinghouse. There's a kind of a waterfall. We drill down into it. There's kind of five components of protection, risk protection. But if they are all permeated, then these clearinghouses are at risk. And that is a big systemic issue.
Well, let's hope that going forward, that plumbing will be as little noticed as possible. Thank you so much for the conversation, Mark.
Great, John. Thank you. Have a good week.
You too.